I'm slipping out, all right?
I will.
Well, I'm going to shock anybody, but I use notes when I do workshops. You don't like it? a little word on home groups. So I got that was terrific, Johnny, and so true. That old Cheers, somebody brought up the bar room, you know. I love that song, Cheers. That's what I was thinking about my home group. I want to go where everybody knows my name. And I was thinking my home group whenever I hear that Cheers song. Clancy talks about some of the home groups. He calls them great tunnel groups. Have you ever heard him talk about that? Johnny has. Johnny says, Clancy says there's these great tunnel groups, and these six guys sit around a table and stay sober. And sobriety is like this long, gray tunnel, and you just trudge. And every year a trapdoor opens and a cake comes down. You been to some of those meetings? Yeah. I want to go where everybody knows my name. I want to go where they're laughing and having a good time. Okay, but I'm supposed to be talking about surrender here. Which is my portion of it. The third step says came to believe, and the sixth step says became entirely ready. I hate that goddamn word, entirely ready. And seven says humbly, which means I know my place. Humbly ask him to remove my shortcomings. So there's a kind of coming to believe, and then taking the action. Nothing happens, I've noticed in Alcoholics Anonymous, nothing happens to me, and I assume in watching other men and working with other men, nothing happens until I surrender first. That's absolutely essential, that surrender has to come before anything else. And, you know, surrender has kind of a bad name. I was raised, you heard me say my father was a professional fighter, and when you're raised by a professional fighter, surrender isn't a big word around your house, you know what I mean? And besides, I'm Irish, I told you that already. The English conquered us, but they never whipped us. They conquered us in the 14th century, and they finally had to let go in the 20th century, because we just kept kicking and screaming and fighting and biting. And so when you're Irish, you don't give. I remember, I'll tell you a story. I was in Long Beach, went down to Long Beach one time with some friends of mine. And we went down to have a good time there in Long Beach from Bakersfield. And I woke up in this Fleabag hotel. And I opened my eyes and I thought I was blind. I had bled face down on this pillow all night, see, and it dried. So when I came up, the goddamn pillow came with me. And I'm in there in a panic. I'm smothering in there. And this other guy and I, there was a sink in the corner of this room. We threw water. We almost drowned then. We kept throwing water on the pillow. Finally went, peeled that pillow off. There was a big mirror on this dresser. I said, put the pillow back. I looked like Quasimodo. You know how it is. But I'll never forget the four guys I was with. They said, you were great, Roach. They said, you got up 19 times. I usually tell that story to demonstrate the kind of friends I had, you know. But it also demonstrates my reluctance to surrender. Surrender, this wasn't in my vocabulary. And Keith was talking. I'd forgotten about that. I was a radical and a rebel in the 60s. My philosophy of political philosophy is blow it up or burn it down. I didn't give a shit which, you know what I mean? Down, you know, and just hated authority of any kind. You know, if it was an authority, I wanted to shoot it. And so that's, you know, the background I came from and coming into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so surrender wasn't a big deal to me. In the second edition of the big book, the book that I read, the one I was telling you about last night that I read over and over and over, there was a story, there was this guy who was this other egotistical school teacher, the professor in the paradox, and he has these three paradoxes, and he says, we surrender to win. What? We surrender to win. We give it away to keep it. Makes a lot of sense to me now. And we die to get well. We die to our old ideas. You know, because the ideas that kill me are not things that are true or not true, are the things that I brought in here that I believe to be true that are wrong. You know, it's like if you learn to swim with an instructor when you're a little kid, you're a very good swimmer. If you learn to swim on your own and then somebody tries to teach you, it's really terrible. And it's, that's what these ideas that I brought in here. Of course, so there's the three things about surrender that I always love to talk about. There's three points about surrender. Number one, it never seems like a good idea. Surrender to me, never at the time, at the moment, never seems like the solution at all. I just the thought of it just makes me quiver. They say, well, you're going to have to turn that over, Cliff. What? After all the fighting I've done, after all I've done. And the second point is, it always works. Never fails. And the third thing is, I always forget that it worked. Nobody's here old enough to remember. I'm the oldest one around here. But right after World War II, there was a movie. It was called Breaking the Sound Barrier. I don't know, probably none of you ever saw it, unless you saw it in some old movie on television or something. But it's a hell of a good movie. And it was about these guys who were breaking the first time they flew in airplanes. When they first did it, they had to do it in a dive to break the sound barrier. And they were all getting killed, you know. They'd never pull out of the goddamn dive. You know? And they said, well, somebody else go up, try that, you know. And in the movie, the effects of the movie were terrific in that when the guy's in the dive, you know how you've seen them when you're in their faces all distorted, and you know, their eyes just... And they're in this dive, and they finally figured out what it was is that at that speed, instead of pulling back on the stick to pull out of it, you had to push forward on it, which is, you know, any pilot, of course, knows better than that. I mean, you've been trained, you know better than that. You never push a stick forward to get out. But because of the dynamics of the thing, and of course in the movie they're screaming it to this guy, he's in the dive, and the dive of death, and they're all back on the radio saying, push the stick forward! And this guy, and he's saying, and he's thinking, bullshit, you know. And finally he goes, he breaks through the sound barrier, you know, there's this piece. And it's just like, oh. And that's the way it is always with me, with surrender. I go through that, and finally I do what I have to push that stick forward, which goes contrary to everything I ever believed. And then I think, oh, why in the hell did I think of that before? That's a piece of cake, for God's sake, you know. Until the next time. Of course, all of us, you know, went through the thing of surrendering to booze. And I've watched people die in the years that I've been sober who just cannot make that surrender that the first half of the first step calls for. The first half of the first step says, I am powerless over alcohol. Now, for 5 years, when I was a slipper in and out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I read the first step, I'm an alcoholic, and my life is unmanageable. I read that over and over and over, but it never registered. And it was only until I read the first half, the first step, right, I am powerless over alcohol. And since I'm powerless over it, I can't drink it. I mean, if it turns out I have cancer today and I'm going to die the day after tomorrow, what the hell? I can't drink alcohol because it's not going to do me any good because I am powerless over it. Nothing's going to happen for me when I drink alcohol. And so for that 5 years, I fought that idea that I was powerless. And of course, I'm sure, went through a similar experience yourself until when you finally just took that first half of the first step, there you go. You know, that now, oh, I see. Not about my life being unmanageable, working on that later, but But the fact is that I am powerless over alcohol, and I can't drink alcohol because I'm powerless over it. I lost a guy that I sponsored, Don, the guy that drives me everywhere to meetings. He got drunk last week. 11 years of sobriety. You know? He forgot that he was powerless over alcohol. Johnny was talking about pills, and he's a guy that suffers terribly, had 4 back operations, you know, and he's just in constant horrible pain, and he takes pills. And I don't judge other people. I tell them, for God's sake, that, you know, they're going to lead you down the road. They cut you off in the sunlight of the Spirit and kill your ass. But he was, you know, it's sad, but it's funny. He was in a restaurant. His back was killing him, and he said, I was out of pills. So the gal said, would you like anything to drink? He says, I'll have a glass of Chardonnay. First half of the first step. So she brought him a glass of Chardonnay. She came back a few months later and said, would you like another glass? He said, no, I'd like the bottle. Of course. That night he went to jail. 11 years of sobriety, drank like 6 hours, and went to jail again. Now he's back, and he's trying, and he's working hard on it. And but, it, you know, that how easy it is to forget, huh? How easy. So I had to surrender to booze, and I did that, and I pretty much stayed surrendered. But I had lots of, my whole sobriety is just one surrender after another damn surrender. I just hate them. One of the things that worked effectively for me all my life was rage. Oh, man, I'm good at rage. I told you about my coaching. You know, I built that speech team just with rage. It's hard work, but if you drink, you can do it. You know, but it wasn't just, it was my whole life has been that way. I told you I'm a coward. And I was the lightweight champion of the Pacific Fleet at the end of World War II. You know, when I could just stand in that corner and I'd look across the ring at that guy, and I'd just work up such a goddamn rage, and I'd just attack him as soon as they rang the bell. You know what I mean? My boxing coach says, this guy's done more with sheer terror than anyone I've ever known in my life. And he's the only one that really knew what he was talking about there. And so rage just worked for me beautifully. And here I get sober, and after about a year, it's killing me. I mean, I'm getting sick every time I get angry. So I went to my sponsor and I said, I guess I have to give up rage. And I said, but it works. It works really well. I've accomplished most things in my life with it. And my sponsor said, too bad. And so I had to go to the sixth and seventh step and ask God to remove that rage. Now, with my team, it was very hard because they expected it. You know, you condition kids over a period of time. You don't do anything when the old man goes off. You know, goes into one of his rages. And I'd catch myself. They'd be all screwing off on the team. Nobody's getting anything done. And I'd start chewing them out. And I'd get going. And I'd start winding up. And I'd look around the room. And they'd all be like. And then I'd catch. I said, no, you don't. He said, any motivation is going to come from you. It's not going to come from me. So when I was able to do that with my team, and they went on winning anyway, but it was a lot easier on me. Now, it was a little harder at home, you know, with my kids, because I'm a physical man. I knocked the crap out of my kids when I was drinking, and I was very, very violent when I was drinking. And when I sobered up for a while, I had a lot of trouble with that rage with my children because they're a bunch of dope fiends, you know. You have to help them. I'll help you, this son of a bitch. And then my sponsor and I got talking about that. And, you know, you're talking about steps 6 and 7. Only God can remove my defective character. Only God can, after I surrender, only God can do it. I have to stay surrendered. I have to keep putting myself in position to let God do it. Seems like the dumbest thing in the world. My sponsor said, anytime you talk to your children, especially if you're even mildly irritated, you are to put both hands in your pockets, and you're not to take them out until that kid's not in your sight anymore. Remarkable, isn't it? Isn't that remarkable? When I was 5 years sober, I remembered one day, talking about spiritual awakenings, I realized I had not hit one of my kids in 5 years. Remarkable what God will do for you if you cooperate. And so I was able to do it in my family. A sense of humor helps, too, after you surrender, huh? I remember the day I learned to laugh at myself. My wife had let I was sober about a year and a half, believe it or not. My wife had let the little kids play with the flashlight again. She was always doing that. She's a wimp. And the little kids, and this was the emergency flashlight, okay? You understand now. So I picked a flashlight, goddamn things out this little, you know. So I went to my wife and said, you let the kids play the flashlight again. She said, well, I said, but, you know, I'm working up a good rage. I'm getting on it, you know what I mean? And I got to this point in this rage where I said, one of these days, we're going to need this flashlight. And I heard me. And I stopped and I said, and we'll all die and it's your fault. My wife was used to rage, you know what I mean? She had lived with it for years, and she fell out of the chair laughing. She rolled on the floor, got me laughing. You ever do that where you're both on the floor and try to crawl away from each other? And she has not taken me seriously since. Nor have I taken me all that seriously since, you know. And so rage was, aside from alcohol, the very hardest thing for me to give up. I've only given in to it maybe a couple times. In 1990, at school, I had absolute good reason for this rage now. Fully justified. I remember I cleaned the principal's desk off for him and, you know, and got in his face and told him what a turd he was and that kind of thing. I mean, it was beautiful, a real rage. And I went home and had a heart attack. A little gal who works in the office, my friend in the office, I said, boy, wouldn't that have made a great video? Portrait of a man about to have a heart attack. She said, oh, yes, oh, yes. But that's the last rage. I don't like rage anymore. Rage makes me sick. I don't even like getting pissed anymore. It's just God has done that for me, and I appreciate it so much. Another area that Keith brought up was politics. You know, I was just could work myself into a frenzy over the government, you know, any government. I don't care what it's, city, state, federal. And that's something I've really had to, you know, really apply the serenity prayer to that one. The idea that, you know, I can vote and I can do whatever I can do, but after that I'm powerless. And for me to stay in a rage and want to blow things up and burn it down and that kind of thing, that would be, it's ridiculous, you know. And so those are some of the areas. And one of the hardest things I've had to surrender was my relationship with my Al-Anon. That, I guess, is the hardest thing, the thing at the home. My wife just simply refuses to love me the way I want to be loved. You know what I mean? All I've ever asked from anybody is absolute obedience and complete adoration. That's all I've ever asked. Doesn't a hell of a lot to ask for, is it? And she just doesn't take me very seriously. You know what I mean? I mean, she does for me all the time. She shows me in every way that she wants to, that she's capable of doing. She shows me in every way that she can that she loves me and respects me and cherishes me. But see, that isn't ever enough for a person like me. You got to do it my way. You have to demonstrate to me that you love me in the way that I want it demonstrated. And that's something I've had to give up because it's very painful. And so what I've had to learn to do is to be sure that my relationship with my higher power is all right, and I don't need any human being then to justify me or to make me whole. And our relationship, you know, going into our 54th year, well into our 54th year, seems to be doing very well when I surrender her to what she is and allow her to be who she is. By the way, I'm going to get all crybaby here about this, but on the last Christmas, My kid spent the whole year putting this book together, my five kids, telling me how much they loved me. Pictures. Had it divided into sections like what I respect about you and the principles you taught me. I had to take salt tablets when I read it, you know. I cried so much. And that's another thing, this crying business. When you're raised in an Irish Catholic tough family like I was, men don't cry. You break your leg, cut it out, you know. Just, women can cry, that's okay. I got into AA and I started crying. I love it so much I can't quit, you know. The surrenders that I've had to make with those kids, you know, let them grow up and let them be who they were and just be an example of somebody who's sober and who acts like a sober person. Look, that's what happened. Now, my kids don't even need to talk to me, and yet they made this book that I can look at and treasure. I'm not going to say it's going to happen to you, but by God, it happened to me. People don't change until they surrender. I was reading a psych book of some kind one time. This guy said, well, Rollo May, he's quite a famous guy in psychiatry. He said people don't change except for two reasons. They can't stand it anymore the way it is. That's the major reason why people make a change. And in AA, we call it start taking the sixth and seventh step. We start utilizing the sixth and seventh step. People don't change until they just can't stand it anymore. I was talking at a convention a little while back, and the guy that led the meeting said, let's have a moment of meditation and think about the last night you drank. I thought that was a beautiful way to start a meeting. And I think that's what it is with most of us. We just drank until we just goddamn couldn't stand it anymore, and we couldn't take the pain of the way it was now, and so we finally just gave it up and surrendered and took the first half of the first step. And so people change. One of the reasons people change is they just can't stand it anymore the way they are, and most of us identify with that. And the second reason the psychiatrist said people change is they get educated to the point where they understand that there is something different. And I see that happen a lot in AA, working with people. A guy named Lanny that I sponsored for years, he was a criminal and a hoodlum, and he was a bum. And I started sponsoring him, and he got a job working on this job. And the guy was promised him so much a day, and when he paid him, he shorted him about $10 a day. That's that way when you're a laborer, you know, and they got you over a barrel. And so he reverted to type. He stole the guy's saw. That'll teach him, you know. And he came to me, big smile on his face. I stole somebody's saw. I fixed him. And I said, no, that's not the way we do it here in AA. I said, so tomorrow you go in and you give him back the saw and you apologize for stealing it. He looked at me like, what? You know, what kind of logic is that? But like me, he had surrendered. You know, he had given up the idea that he was in charge of his life. You know, he had a sponsor in a home group, which Johnny was talking about. And although he knew that was the stupidest thing he ever heard, he took the saw back the next day and actually apologized. I don't think Lanny had ever apologized to anybody in his life. And he worked the rest of the day, and at the end of the day, the guy came and gave him all the money that Lanny felt like he owed him. That's an educational thing in AA. You know, that being right will work too. And I have example after example after example of that. My sponsor, Bill, sponsored a guy down in San Diego, and we went down and had lunch with this guy just many, many years ago. This guy was quite wealthy, and this guy had a son who was a drug addict, and so the father had loaned the kid money to buy a car, but he made the kid sign a contract, bona fide contract, so much a month, and he hadn't got a payment yet, you know what I mean? And Bill said, so what are you asking me? And the guy said, well, you know, Bill said, do you want to feel better? And the guy said, yeah. So Bill said, sign the pink slip and give it to him. And the guy said, what? Let the son of a bitch off the hook? He hasn't paid me a single payment. And my sponsor said, oh, I thought you wanted to feel better. I says, well, I do. Sign the pink slip and give it to him. The guy, a couple of days later, the guy called and said, Bill, I signed the pink slip and gave it to him. I feel great. I said, Bill. Now, the kid came back later and paid him, but that doesn't matter. The guy surrendered the need for that kid to shape up and do as he wanted. So it's just it was an amazing one to me, really an amazing one. You know, Bob Darrell, I was talking to somebody earlier today. His father died and left a lot of money, and his sister found some way to steal the money from him and gave him a little box of coins. And Bob was beside himself, and everybody he talked to said, yeah, you got to take her to court, you got to get even, you know, that kind of thing. And Clancy, who was his sponsor, said, oh, no, just let her have the money. And it didn't seem like a good idea to Bob, you know. But he did. And, of course, when he surrendered the idea that she had to be fair, he was happy. Bob was, because Bob had money anyway. You know, he didn't need that money. And then not 6 months later, the sister came and apologized and gave him his share. Now, those all are good, happy endings, but I've surrendered lots of things in AA that turned out badly. But the fact that I surrendered is what made me happy. Do you understand what I mean? Do you follow me? And that's what 6 and 7 are all about. You know, 6 is the 6 and 7 are the ways that we allow, the way I allow God to change me. The action of putting my hands in my pockets. The actions of not taking action against my children. I remember my son called me from Long Beach. He was in jail. He was 18 then, and he said, Dad, I'm in jail up here in Long Beach. And I said, well, what are you in jail for, Dave? He said, possession of marijuana. I said, well, give us a call when you get out. I allowed my son to pay the price, and, you know, he's got 2 years of sobriety today. And that's what, you know, after I surrender, the only answer I have then is to allow God to change me. I can't change myself. I've long since given up the idea that Cliff can change himself. All I can do is, Bill used to say, act like I believe God is changing me. Okay? And that's all I've learned about surrender. It's the most important, the absolute first step of anything in my life is the idea of surrender. And so when you share, those of you who get called on to share, I'd like to hear your adventures with surrender. What's something that's been very difficult for you to surrender? Or on the other hand, what's something that's been relative? You see other people struggling with it, some aspect of your life, but you've been able to surrender it pretty easily. I think that's an easy way, too. Is there anybody here who's not going to surrender one thing like God? Tell us about that. Through your clenched teeth and your puckered anus. Tell us about how you're not going to surrender that bitch, I'll tell you for sure. Yep. Okay, thanks a lot. Morning, my name's Cliff Roach and I'm an alcoholic. And, I'm supposed to talk about the promises this morning. Anytime I think about the promises, I remember the first time I saw them. Sober 19 months, and I had done a second inventory because I'd screwed up the first one. And, you know, and it was well into my road to sobriety. And my sponsor had a deal where you had to read the book at least twice a year, and preferably three times a year all the way through. The dumber guys, he gave them page assignments, but us smart guys, he let us just read it. And so, you know, I'd read the book. Of course, I had read it in my travels before I came on the program. This is on the program this time, and I had read it probably five times by then. And I was... was really late. It was about 3 o'clock in the morning. I'd had a lot of trouble sleeping. Really? And 19 months sober. And As I said, I had read the promises many times. And if you, you know, we got a few new guys there at the bottom of page 83, the top of page 84. But that night, I saw them. It was like they were luminous. They just lifted up off the page. And I saw them. The most remarkable thing that's happened to me in sobriety. And I never forget that moment. Never forget it. Now, I realize now, I saw them, finally, because they had started to come true in my life. I'm with Johnny's. I'm a taker. I was born a taker, and that's the way I lived my whole life. Just getting mine. At your expense if I had to, and that was tough. You know, just because I didn't go to prison a lot of times, that doesn't mean I didn't feel exactly like Johnny. I felt exactly like Johnny my whole life, and, you know, and whether I was in a cell or not, I had an old cell right here where I lived. But anyway, I saw those promises. It said I was going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. You know, whenever time I see the part there, it says, I will not regret the past or wish to shut the door at it. My wife and I, because of our experience with our kids, have been of great help to many, 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 many people when they're having problems with their kids. Because we've had it all. They used to go see the Roaches. They've had it all, you know. And, you know, essentially I can tell them, you love them and let them go is what you do. You just love them and mind your own goddamn business. But at the same time, you know, because my wife and I went through all that, our dark past, another part of the book says, my dark past is my greatest asset. And so we've been able to help people. Said, I was going to comprehend the word serenity and no peace. And then that's it. The phrasing of the big book is absolutely perfect, isn't it? Because I comprehend the word serenity. I always have sure that serenity was some kind of a hot flash experience, you know, where God reached down and lifted me up, you know, an electrical bolt up my ass or something like that, you know what I mean? And I would just understand the world right then. I would know serenity, you know, as a guru type of thing. And I have come to understand the serenity. It's walking around in my own skin comfortably. That's what serenity is. Just being Cliff Roach and being satisfied with being Cliff Roach and that being enough. See, I will comprehend the word serenity. Isn't that interesting, crazy? And I will know peace. I will know peace. Mother Teresa was in our area about 8 or 9, 10 years ago. She was in the San Diego area, and she had a heart attack, and she was in the hospital there at Scripps, and a good buddy of mine is a cardiologist, was one of them that took care of her, a whole team of guys took care of her there. They were really impressed with her. They said you couldn't be in the room with her and not know that she was a real spiritual being. But some reporter asked her this question, I forgot what he asked her, but the answer is what got me. It was in the paper, and I cut it out and carried it around until it just rotted away. She said to this guy, the fruit of faith is love. And the fruit of love is service. And the fruit of service is peace. I will comprehend the word serenity, and I will know peace. And the fruit of service is peace. You know, and then the promises went on to say that I'll be able to handle situations which used to baffle me, like life. You know, just like living every day. The situations used to baffle me. And it says that the fear of people and of economic insecurity, I always loved the phrasing there. It doesn't say economic insecurity is going to leave me, you know. Just fear of it. 33 years ago, I was on the verge of bankruptcy and divorce, and here it is 33 years later, and I'm on the verge of bankruptcy and divorce. But it doesn't bother me. I'm not afraid of it anymore. It says that God will do for me what I never could do for myself. And everybody in this room knows exactly what I'm talking about there, that God will handle situations that, you know, used to baffle me, and he'll just take care of things. If I just turn it over, I'll be all right. And there I was, 3 o'clock in the morning, I was all by myself, and I saw the promises. And as I said, I think I saw them because they had started to happen in my life. And I read them, and I just kind of enumerated most of them here for us. I don't know what kind of person you were when you came here, but Johnny and I were just a hell of a lot alike. You know what I mean? My whole life was based on fear. Everything, every thought I ever had, every reaction I ever had, every goal I ever had was because, you know, I was fear-oriented. The book says I'm afraid of, I'm not going to get something that's owed to me, or that I'll be cheated out of something, or, you know. But fear was just permeated about everything about my life was fear. And after I was sober a while, I read this Jewish theologian, Martin Buber. He said there's only 2 emotions in the world. There's only 2. There's love and there's fear. That's all. That's all it is. Then he said, they are mutually incompatible, which I thought was really the way to put it. You know, I can live in a state of fear, I can live in a state of love, but I can't do both. I can't mix them up. And so I saw those promises there, and then it said, are these extravagant promises? Oh, no. The reason I had never seen them is because they're beyond my comprehension. Maybe you're not like me. I don't know. But the promises are so alien to the way I had lived my life before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, it just struck me funny. You know, are these extravagant promises? Oh, hell no. You know, I'm going to live happy and joyous and free and that kind of thing. And I got to laughing. And the more I read that line about these extravagant promises, the harder I laughed. Pretty soon my wife came out and said, what the hell's the matter with you? You know? And you try to explain something like that, and then you laugh so hard you get sick. And so every time when somebody reads these at a meeting or something, and now in California, Johnny and I just love it. We have people out there that love to add things. They've been through a treatment center where they showed them how to do that. And they... you know, at the end of the chapter 5, they said, God could and would have sought. You know, I just want to slap them in the face as soon as it... And then at the end of the traditions, they had to join in. And in this one, in the promises, what really pissed me off is right there they say, are these extravagant promises? They all say, we think not. Oh. I mean, if you're going to chant in the promises, at least chant the last line, if we work for them, you know what I mean? If you're going to chant that goddamn thing, you know. But in case you're new here, right down in the middle of the promises, Bill Wilson, you know, the absolute master of writing, he knew exactly what he was doing. He took, and hidden right in the middle, he puts how we make the promises come true, doesn't he? He says, no matter how far down a scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. A lot of times, you know, when I'm working with new guys and we're going through the book, I'll ask them what that means. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. And almost always they say, well, you know, a guy, if he's been skid row or living in a prison cell in solitary confinement, then he can get reached. He can go to prison then and help people. You know, if you're only going down the scale a little bit, you can be of just as much value in Alcoholics Anonymous because you only went down the scale a little bit. I mean, if you were an intellectual jerk, you can help other intellectual jerks when they come along. Do you understand what I mean? That's what Bill meant there. No matter where you are on the scale, there's somebody then you can help better than anybody else. And that's why you got sober when you got sober, because the book is just full of references. The best one is, it's like we found a great gold mine, and we mine it every day and have to give it all away. That's the most blatant part of the book, says this. If you find this wonderful gold mine and you mine it day in and day out and dig out these treasures and then give every damn bit of it away, then you're on your way. Most of us probably, if we found a gold mine, we wouldn't be looking around about who we could give it to. The third step prayer says, do this for me so that I can show other people how to do it. And the seventh step prayer says, remove my difficulties so that I can give it away. Everything, every one of the surrender steps is something. So give me this so I can help other people. So now right in the middle of the promises, it says, no matter how far down the scale we've gone, we'll see how our experience can benefit others. Then, my favorite line in the whole book, I don't know what your favorite line is, this is my favorite. The other English teacher will join with me here. He says, that feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. Now, we English teachers know that that's very poor grammar. That's poor syntax. That should read. These feelings of uselessness and self-pity, uselessness and self-pity, these feelings. Bill knew exactly what he was writing, didn't he? Show me a loser, and I'll show you somebody who doesn't do jack and feel sorry for himself. It's part of the deal, isn't it? If I'm not doing anything for you, then I have plenty of time to think about how bad off I am and how the world has mistreated me and, all these things. That, isn't it perfect? That feeling of uselessness and self-pity, all the same emotion, will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. I'm still waiting on that. But it's better than it used to be. When I was still drinking, I read a book years and years ago by a guy named Gerald Van. He was a Trappist monk and lived in England. One of those monks, that doesn't say anything his whole life, just prays for the rest of us, And he wrote this book called The Heart of Man, was the name of the book. And he wrote it in 1946, and it was a very prophetic book. Everything he wrote about in that book has pretty much come true, sociologically speaking. But I was reading this book. I had a glass of scotch. I'm sucking away on a scotch. I'm reading this book. And this guy said, I'm going to paraphrase him, but it's pretty close. I'll never forget it as long as I live. He said, I am part of every man who ever lived. And no matter how infinitesimally, every man who lives after me will be a part of me. And that every action I take affects the balance of good and evil in the world. And for that, I am responsible. I read that. I threw that goddamn book across the room. Hit about five walls, Man, I didn't want to hear that. I didn't want to hear that when I looked back over my life and see what I had contributed. I'd done some good things in my life, but if you'd have put my actions on a balance of good or evil and how the world was going to do, we were screwed. And that's the thing with me, in the middle of the promises. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we're so lucky. I suppose it happens in religions too, but to me, the only thing I know is Alcoholics Anonymous, that we can see so quickly here when our actions have contributed, huh? Just, you get a new guy, And you get him to a couple of meetings, and he starts laughing. And he cleans up, and pretty soon he's got a job. Pretty soon he's got some other new guy. I don't know anything to me that's more moving for me than to see a guy I sponsor giving another guy a cake that he sponsors. And we had a lot of that here this weekend, a lot of this genealogy sponsors. Who begat. And there's nothing, nothing better in the world to me than to see that. And we see it immediately. And we get the benefit of understanding that feeling that the world's getting better and we're being part of the world and improvement of the world. It's absolutely incredible to see that happen. There's a guy that I 12-step that was just an animal. And I bet you he sponsors 25, 30 people today. And he's one of the most loving people on the face of the earth. And I'm the one that 12-stepped him. That doesn't make me anything, but at the same time, I can see how the world is getting a little bit better because of me. We kind of have an inverted order of importance here, don't we? If you were in 37 nut houses and 5 prisons, you have a little more. I always say, well, I've never been in prison, but I sponsor a guy who did. And that's about the best you can do. I think the words that piss me off the most in AA is when, if I'm working with somebody and we'll mention some glaring defect of character the guy has, and he'll say to me, well, that's the way I am. And then when he gets up, it just infuriates me because, that's why we came here. We came here because we couldn't stand the way we are. And so, if you're not willing to change, you're not going to be able to stay here. You have to change. And that's what steps 6 and 7 are all about. The most misunderstood, underestimated, overlooked, and ignored steps in the program, and probably, the most important steps in the program, are 6 and 7. And in my case, and with me, I've made a real practice of step 10 being part of my working on step 6 and 7. Because step 10 is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 on a daily basis. And what I do in my before I meditate, I go over my life, and there's those defects of character, and then the number one defect of character, Johnny was nailed it last night. We used a little different terminology. You were saying self-serving, and the word I like, the word used is self-obsession. The book talks about self-obsession all the time. And then in 3 places, the book talks about how self-obsession can lead to self-delusion. That's my favorite. Did you ever walk down a bar and punch a guy because you knew what he was thinking about him? I know what you're thinking about me. And sometimes, I'll say to my wife, well, I know you thought this. And she'll say, where the hell did that come from? What planet sent you that information? Self-obsession will lead to self-delusion. Because if you're all alone in there, you can tell yourself anything you want. And you believe it. I've heard, maybe 200 fifth steps in my years in AA. And the number one defect of character of every single fifth step I ever heard is self-obsession. I don't understand Al-Anons at all. They spend all that time thinking about somebody else. I ain't much, but I'm all I think about. self-obsession, which leads, of course, to self-delusion, which is very, very dangerous, but selfishness and self-centeredness, I think that's the word Johnny was using last night, self-centeredness. And the only thing that can save a person like me is the middle of the promises. I have to lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in my fellows. You know, sometimes I spend an hour a day thinking about you. Remember Dr. Paul used to have this great story where he had this little problem of some kind, and he says, but he got in his easy chair and he started thinking about the problem. Maybe it wasn't as little as he thought, you know. Pretty soon he had cancer, you know. He was dying of cancer. And then the phone rings and some Yahoo sponsors calls, and he said, with some petty problem of his. And by the time he gets through talking with his sponsee, it was at this petty problem, and he hangs up and he says, now, what was that problem I had? I got to remember that major problem I was suffering from. And that's what's, you know, we just bother each other so that we can stay out of our own damn heads, you know what I mean? Boy, I wish I had 1,000 guys to sponsor. I could be happy as hell, you know? But thank God the ones I have are really sick, so that keeps me busy as hell, you know? And my wife's a marriage and family therapist, you know, and she works with people all the time. But she, in the morning, you know, the phone rings like, I mean, it's just, you know. And last week she said to me, you're just remarkable. Me? Love to hear that. She said, you know, you listen, you know, and respond. And you seem to say the right thing. I gave her a big kiss. Because I had noticed that. See what I mean? I had noticed that I was really listening to those goofs. And trying to respond in a way that you know, help them. And isn't it great, though? You know, in AA, you can talk to some guy. Some guy will call Cliff and say, oh, I have this terrible problem, blah, blah, blah. And I'll listen and I'll say, well, you know what the book says? The book says, blah, 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 blah. And I go, well, thank you, Cliff. You know, you hang up and think, boy, that Cliff, he's brilliant. But 2 hours later, I'm calling my sponsor. And Johnny Ackerman will say, well, you know what the book says, Cliff. Oh, thank you, John. And, for, you know, I'm sure an hour or so later, he's calling his sponsor. Talking in Swedish. Boys, he got problems. And so, if I can just tie back in with it, with John's very, very great talk last night where he said, if for the most part, I certainly know he has, And people like Clancy and people that I admire, we have stopped being takers. And to a great degree, we have become givers. And that's where the happiness is. And that's what the promises are all about, I think. It's helping me stop being a taker and become a giver and become happy in that way. Because self-obsession is not the way to go. Okay, thanks.